Then I don't know.
Okay.
Okay, so because we didn't do Parshas Pinchas last year, we will try to speak briefly about some key points in the first two aliyahs of Parshas Pinchas, which cover a lot of psukim, but not that many different themes, because the second aliyah is a very long one, but the second aliyah has a lot of the names. So we won't spend so much time talking about it, maybe just to make a point here and there. In general, Parshas Pinchas tends to be read at the beginning of the 3 weeks, and it's sometimes observed, in the Chassidus HaShvarim, they point out that it seems to be that it's appropriate, because you would think it's inappropriate, but maybe it's appropriate, Dafka, that Parshas Pinchas is one of the Parshas where we read through the Moadim, where we're told about all the Yom Tovim. So it feels a little bit ironic to be reading about that now, as we're in a negative time period, a period of mourning, except that that's really the point, that we know that the Gemara tells us in Masachas Rosh Hashanah that these days will be L'sas and L'simcha, these days will ultimately be holidays. And it's therefore incumbent upon us to keep our eye on the ball, to remember that we're looking to the time when we will flip this period into a holiday period, and therefore to be reminded of the concept of Moadim in the beginning of the 3 weeks is perhaps especially appropriate, not ironic. There is a discussion about this in the Sefer Paris Yosef HaChadash, and if I remember correctly, he quotes there from various farim, different scenarios, about how it's expected that this Yantif season will turn out. That some have it that it's going to be Shavasar Batamas will be the first day Yantif, and Tisha B'Av will be the last day Yantif, and the 3 weeks will be Chol HaMoed. And others have it reversed. Others suggest that Tisha B'Av will be the first day Yantif, and Shavasar Batamas will be the last day Yantif. So the 49 weeks in between will all be Chol HaMoed. So the problem with that scenario is it still comes out then that the 3 weeks will still be the saddest time of the year, but only because the rest of the year will be elevated to such a degree. But in any event, we have this idea, the Gemara tells us, based on the Pasuk in Zechariah, that ultimately we'll be celebrating these weeks as a Yantif, and therefore perhaps to read about the Moadim in this week is appropriate. There are many discussions you can find in many Sfarim. Simon has an essay for so the Ohel Moshe has a long essay about this. The idea of the connections between Parshas Pinchas and the 3 weeks, there's quite a bit to say about it. So in any event, so the Parsha begins telling us the story of Pinchas, who was just picked up from last week's Parsha, the end of Parshas Balak. So we know that Pinchas does an act of zealotry, an act of kanos, and kills the Baal Aramis. And the Torah says that he did the right thing, apparently, even though halachically it's a question. This kanos is something that we're not told that we can really implement, and we have to be very careful about. And it represents both an attitude and an action that nowadays we're wary of with justification. And it's in the category, really, of halach of a modern king. It's more theoretical, b'sman hazeh, but it still represents a abstract model, at least for us, of somebody who's so moved by seeing a Chil Hashem, somebody who sees God's name trampled, that he's so bothered by it that he has to act. So even if nowadays that's not the path that we take, and it's not a path that's going to be either permissible or really productive, it's not really a way to get anybody to change their behavior. Nowadays, we live in a very different generation with very different challenges. But the notion of Pinchas' commitment and Pinchas' complete identification with the spiritual sensitivity, so much so that he just couldn't handle it, and he had to act, he had to do something, is something that we still look at with respect. So the Gemara in Masechet Sanhedrin and Daf Pei Beis, the Gemara makes note of the fact that the Torah emphasizes that he was Ben Aaron HaKohen. So Rashi has the famous comment of why is it that the Torah tells us to emphasize that he was Ben Aaron? So Rashi says, "Lefi shahayu hashvatim mevazen oso," that the shvatim, they were mevazen him, they would make fun of him, they would degrade him And they say, Harisem, but put these shapitem avi imo agalum of Arazara of Harignasi, Shavit me Israel, Fikach Baakas of Yachso Acharam. That the accusation is people would make fun of him, saying, look, he's descended from Yisro, he's descended from a person who was involved in preparing animals for Avodah Zarah, and he's going to kill a Nasi, a Shevet Yisrael. How could that be? So the Torah connects him to Aaron. So it's not an obvious point what exactly the message there is. Some point out about how Aaron himself, in the aftermath of the Parsha of Korach, Aaron was involved in this type of righteous settling of God's anger, so therefore it's a more relevant yichus for Pinchas to invoke. I think it's related a little bit to the question of what is it that they were accusing him of? What were the Shvatim making fun of him about? The Torah Tamima discusses this, the Rebbe Kamenetsky discusses this. In the Torah Tamima, they suggest that maybe they were jealous of him, so now he's the big hero, so they have to say something to explain the sour grapes, why, you know, why they didn't do what he did. Or maybe they recognize the fact, like we said before, that this is not the kind of action you can get rabbinic endorsement for. Chazal and Rabbanon in general can't allow l'chadchilu this kind of behavior, so maybe for that reason they held out a grudge against him. Rebbe Kamenetsky writes in his Emes Yaakov that they suspected that he didn't have the full pure intent that would be necessary for this to be considered a real act of kandalos, and therefore they were worried that this was just an act of Ritzicha. So I think it's possible to say that we look at the question of what motivates a person to act with such zealotry. And as we mentioned, nowadays, and always, but especially nowadays, it's very, very hard to say that a person who would take an action, not just an action of killing someone like Pinchas did, but even any action of Kanos, it becomes very difficult to say that their motives are really 100% pure. And therefore, that calls into question the whole legitimacy of the action. But an example of that, perhaps, is what you find here, that maybe the Shvatim say, look, he's got this embarrassing yichus, he has idolatry in his past. So because of that, he has to go extra hard, he has to bend over backwards even more to show what a religious guy he is, that this person, because of his history with idolatry, he's going to be too rough on the person who's committing an aveira. He's got to go extra lengths to show how firm he is in order to dispute any baggage, in order to get rid of any baggage that he has from being descended from an Ovid of a Tzar. So perhaps that was the accusation, that they didn't think he was really sincere. They thought that it was his feelings of inadequacy based on his history that pushed him into this action. So to that he responds, or to that the Torah responds on his behalf. He doesn't have any feelings of inadequacy. On his other side, he's a descendant of Aaron HaKohen. He doesn't have that motive. He doesn't feel like he has to cover up for his past by being extra aggressive on the kanos front. Any kanos that he would have is legitimate, is genuine. It's an expression of real concern because he could equally point with pride to his yichus. He doesn't have any problems in that area. Rashi comments on the kanos kinasi, that Rashi's language, b'katzpo, it's like kesef shahayeli liktov, that he took this step, this kind of angry step, that God himself otherwise would have had to take. And Rav Moshe Feinstein has a little bit of an essay there where he explains the quality of kanos, although I still think it requires a word of warning, but that he says the idea is that somebody who acts so that a Kaddish Baruch Hu won't have to, so to speak. So here this person is a sinner, and he was b'machal Hashem Shamayim, and he was really weakening the spiritual fortitude of the Jewish people, so God would have had to act, and instead of God having to act, so Pinchas gets involved instead. And Rav Moshe compares it to the whole idea of tzedakah, where, you know, the Gemara talks about Eternus Rufus, about the question that was asked of Rabbi Akiva, that people say, well, I don't want to give tzedakah, or I don't want to be a doctor, or I don't want to help people, because I'm undermining God's plan. If God meant for this person to be poor, if God meant for this person to be sick, so who am I to contradict that by trying to help the situation? And Akiva responds that, no, that's not the case at all. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to join with him in this effort, and if it wasn't for you doing it, so he would do it himself. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu is giving human beings the ability to take part in this as an expression of love. And he gives a mashal that, let's say you have a mother who has a little baby, an infant, let's say a toddler, and the mother's carrying the heavy bags, and the toddler says she wants to help mommy also, so she's going to help. So even though she's not really helping, she's not strong enough to make a difference, but the mother lets the kid help because she's happy that the kid wants to help. She recognizes an expression of love, even though it's not really taking away at all from the burden of the mother. So too, there are certain actions which HaKadosh Baruch Hu would do himself, and the fact that we want to take that on, so that's an expression of love that HaKadosh Baruch Hu appreciates. But again, I think we have to be careful that when we're told Valach the Bedrachav that we should actually follow in his path, so then the Gemara generally assumes that's a reference to things like Chesed, like that Staka model, that I think that's the area we're meant to focus in terms of taking on God's work and in terms of punishing people. So Bezman Azad, we generally assume that's not our area, and that the whole Kanos angle is something that we're not really, we don't really find accessible for ourselves in terms of a Pinchas-like model. So, in any event, the pasuk continues that Pinchas accomplished something. Yeshivas chamisim yal bnei Yisrael b'kano es kenasi b'socham v'lo chilisi es bnei Yisrael b'kenasi v'achein emor hinani nosein lo es brisi shalom. So he says, Kadosh Baruch Hu declares, I am going to give my covenant, I am going to give my bris of shalom to him. So what exactly does that mean? It's not clear what the bris of shalom is. We see that he bestows upon him the kahuna, which theoretically he should have had himself because he was a descendant of Aaron, except that he was already alive when the kahuna was given to Aaron. So he didn't get it. Excuse me. He didn't get it himself. So now he gets to become a kohen through this. But it's interesting. This word shalom, whatever it's meant to invoke here, is worth paying a lot of attention to. You know, one could say that maybe this is a better reason why we read Pinchas in the 3 weeks, that the idea we mentioned before about the Moadim being a reminder that the 3 weeks are going to turn into a festive time. So the Gemara says in Maseches Rosh Hashanah, when it darshens that pasuk in Zechariah, that there'll be holidays. So the Gemara says, so terrific, so when's that going to happen? When are they going to be holidays? So the Gemara says that it's going to be celebrated as holidays, Bizman Shiei Shalom. When we have Shalom in the world, that's when we're going to have these days as holidays. So here, Pinchas is told, you're going to get Brisi Shalom. It's a very significant word. So the word Shalom here, though, is spelled in a funny way, that the Vav is broken up. The Vav is Kitiya, as the Gemara calls it. If you look in the Chumashim, you see that the Vav looks different than the normal Vav. And the Gemara has a drasha based on that, that a Baal Mum is not qualified to do the Avoda. But there is a big machlokas, what exactly is the proper formulation of that Vav? The Gemara calls it a Vav Kitiya, the Gemara in Kedusha. But the later Svarim, and this is very important because you have to know how to write a Kashra Sefer Torah, so it's a little chaval that this is a machlokas. It seems we can't even agree on what Shalom is, which is a little bit sad. But there are at least three shitas, if not more, as to what this shalom is. If you look in the Marasha, so he writes that the word that it's meant to convey is shalem, that it should be as if the vav is really like a yud, like the bottom part is missing, so it's like a yud, so the word reads shalem, and that's where you get this drasha that the person who does the avoda has to be physically complete. The Chasam Sofer and the Ritva, they understand differently. They understand that there's a slice through the middle of the Vav, so that creates two Yuds. And if you put two Yuds, you rearrange them around this word, so you have the word Yashlim, that Pinchas Hu Elyo, Pinchas Elyo, he will make peace, he will bring peace between man and his brother. And then there is the third Shita, the Shita of Rabbeinu Bechaya, possibly the Panei Achraza and others, that the idea is the Vav is a small Vav. It's just a basic reduction in size, but it's otherwise a normal Vav. So Rabbi Akiva Eiger was very concerned about this. He talks about in his Tshuvas the instructions he would give the Sofer how to write the Vav in Parshas Pinchas and the Torah. It's not a simple question. So like I said, it's a little bit ironic. We can't even agree on the word Shalom. It doesn't really bode well for us. But perhaps the point is, we say Shuvim Panim LaTorah, that all these different meanings are meant to be taken together, that if we want to really bring about peace in the world, so we need to have all these things, that we need to have Shlemus, that's what peace means. Peace means that everything can coexist in harmony because they are all together in non-conflicting ways. So that's Shlemus. I think we've commented in the past, I feel like this came up recently for some reason, that the Gemara in the end of four Masechtas, Masechtas Brachos, and three other Masechtas, the Gemara ends with a phrase that some people have called the best joke in the Talmud, an example of the sense of humor, that the Gemara says that Talmidei Chachamim marvim shalom ba'olam. Talmidei Chachamim increase peace in the world, and that's always a little bit hard to understand. There's so much machlokas, there's so much arguing in the Gemara, how could you say they increase peace? So Rav Kook has a discussion about this in his commentary to Maseches Brachos, where he basically says that the Talmidei Chachamim, they show us that the different opinions in the world can all coexist, can all come together to create harmony. So shalom is a form of shalom, that if everything is full, is complete and integrated, so that's a type of shalom. And then yashlim is the idea that the shalom should last, that it should be a future shalom as well, that a shalom that doesn't hold, that's just a temporary patch, so that's not a real shalom either. And then perhaps we could take one more step, that the third sheet, that the small vav is what's indicated in shalom, is that sometimes if you're going to bring shalom, you have to be able to make yourself small. You have to be able to let your ego take a back seat and to not worry so much about how you're going to come out in the picture, but to be able to be mitzamtzim, to shrink yourself a little bit, that's sometimes necessary in order to get to shalom. So maybe the pasuk is telling us through this very open-ended question of how the vav should look, that there's a different ramazim contained within this word shalom, and all of them are harmonious towards bringing the goal of shalom. It's interesting that the Lutzke Rav, he has Naim Mutara, so he suggests that the vav is broken because the shalom that was brought about by Pinchas is a shalom that we regret, in a sense. Not that we regret that he did it, but we regret that it was necessary, because since it's shalom that came about through a violent act, so even though sometimes that has to happen, but that's a shalom that we don't take such celebration in. We look for a shalom which doesn't have to happen through an act of violence. And it's evocative of an idea we've mentioned in the past, when Moshe Rabbeinu broke the luchos, and then he had to make another set of luchos. And that also, Chet Egel, happened on Shavas Batamas. It's also a timely point. So he broke the luchos. So after he made the other set of luchos, so Kadosh Baruch Hu said to him, "Psal lecha shnei luchos avanim karishonim," that you should make the second set of luchos. And the Yalkut Shimoni says, the reference of psal lecha, you should make the luchos, is in order to say that you, Moshe, you should know what's involved in making luchos. You didn't make the first set. You think they're so cheap you could just throw them off the side of the mountain. You should know how expensive luchos are. You should make the next set. So that's a hard idea to understand. We assume that Moshe did the right thing. It says, the Gemara says in Yevamos, as luchos asher shibarta, yashikoch shibarta. Moshe did the right thing in breaking the luchos. So many of the Balei Musar suggest that even though Moshe made the right decision, but still he had to recognize what was the loss, what was the price that was paid in order to get to this point. So the broken luchos, there had to be, but it was still a cost, and he had to have an appreciation for that cost. So here too, there's a shalom that was brought about, but it's not a shalom yet. It's the kind of shalom that we're looking for. We're looking for a shalom that doesn't have to come at the cost of someone's life, doesn't have to come through an act of violence, and therefore the shalom that's mentioned here is both necessary and still there's a broken vav. And it's interesting, that point that was made by the Lutzke Rav, I think it parallels another point that the Lutzke Rav makes elsewhere, those Naim Torah makes elsewhere, that the Torah, when it tells us, is a prohibition to lie. So the Torah says, Midvar Sheker Tirchak, we should stay far away from falsehood. The Svarim all try to figure out, why do we have this language of Tirchak? That's not the normal way the Torah has a prohibition. Normally, if something is Aser, the Torah says, don't, Hishamer, Lav, Padal, or all kinds of languages to say don't. What is the intent of saying Tirchak? So it's a topic that many discuss. And the Lutzke Rav suggests that maybe the idea is the Torah says, Tirchak, stay away, in recognition of the fact that there are times when it's necessary to lie. We spoke about this a little bit during the year. We learned the second parak of Bava Metzia, so that comes up there as well. There are times when it's acceptable to lie because it's necessary because of the circumstances, with Neha Shalom and the like. And the Aznaim Latorah suggests that therefore the Torah says stay away from Sheker in order to indicate that even though it's necessary sometimes, but hopefully you'll try to live a life where that comes up as infrequently as possible. Because the Pasuk in the end, the Pasuk in Zechariah that talks about these Taneisim, the Pasuk we're talking about the whole time, says the Taneisim will ultimately be holidays. V'ha'emes v'ha'shalom ahavu, and peace and truth are beloved. And maybe the idea is that sometimes we have to sacrifice truth for peace. But if we're careful, we could try to set up our lives where we esteem both values so much that we'll try to make sure that they're not going to come into conflict with each other. And therefore, that's what's involved of Hemes v'Shalom Ahavu, loving them both together. That's what will bring about the resolution of this period of the 3 weeks. So perhaps all of this is merumas in this broken vav that we find here in the Bris Yishalom that was bestowed upon Pinchas. So then the pasuk goes on to talk about the kahuna, and the next pasuk tells us about who it was that was taken down here. It was the Shem Ish Yisrael Hamukah Asher Hukas Hamijanis Zimri Ben Salu. Pasuk continues Nesi Beis Av L'Shimoni, that he was one of the heads of the family of Shimon. And Rashi has two lashonos. Rashi says he was one of the five heads of Shimon. And also, Davar Acher, the fact that he was a Nasi didn't stop Pinchas from acting, didn't stop Pinchas from doing what he did. So what's the connection between those two halves, those two mandamrim? So Moshe Feinstein suggests that really they are connected points, that what Rashi is telling us is that the Aveira was a bigger Aveira, was a bigger problem, was a bigger Chil Hashem, because it was a big person doing it, because it was a Nasi who was doing it. And therefore, that also was part of the problem. That was part of the Hasasa, the fact that he was bringing other people into being tempted to sin or thinking it was appropriate to sin had to do with the fact that it wasn't just somebody doing an Aveira, but a person of great prominence. So therefore, Pinchas' act, it's not just that he killed him, but that Pinchas, by not being intimidated by this fact that he was a Nasi, not saying, okay, if he's doing it, that's the way to go, but showing that that was very much not his thinking. So he, through that action, also diffused the impact that his Hasasa was having, and that's a part of the accomplishment of Pinchas. It's also interesting that a few psukim later, in Pasuk Yitess, so then the Torah says, Vayhi achar ha-magefa, and it was after this whole magefa, after the whole plague. So that's how Pasuk Yitess, the beginning of Chavav. So after this magefa, so what happened to the magefa? So the Pasuk says actually in Tehillim, in Parakavav of Tehillim, the Pasuk tells us that Pinchas davened and the magefa stopped. And the language is Vayipalel Pinchas. So why not Vayispalel Pinchas? So the Gemara in Sanhedrin asks about that, and the Gemara says that it shows you that Pinchas actually engaged in plilum, in judgment, that he kind of took God to court, so to speak, and said, how is it you're going to let all these people who didn't necessarily sin, they're all going to keep dying in this magefa, you got to stop it, so you stopped it. So it's interesting, I saw an idea in the Sefer Bechia that talks about the notion that when we talk about tefillah and why it is that tefillah is meant to accomplish anything, it's a question the philosophers have always discussed. What exactly is the method by which tefillah accomplishes things? Okay, just because you ask for something, why should HaKadosh Baruch Hu give it? If he wasn't inclined to give it to you beforehand, why should he give it to you now just because you're asking for it? And the Sefer HaYikarim has a famous approach where he suggests that tefillah is such a transformative process that by the time you finish, you're a different person than you were when you started. And therefore, it could be that before you davened, you were not worthy of getting whatever you asked for. But after you davened, then by the time you're finished, you are worthy. And along those lines, I think Rav Shem Shimon Fal Hirsch and a number of others understood that the whole phrase, lehispalel, which normally that whole formulation, that binyan, would mean something you are doing to yourself, lehispalel, It comes from the idea that plilus is a judgment and lehis is to do to yourself, that basically tefillah is an act of introspection, it's an act of self-judgment, and through that process you end up a better person, and that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu hopefully gives you what you want. So that's a normal tefillah, but here in this context in Tehillim, so we see that basically Pinchas is not involved personally. Pinchas is this external force of Kanos. So too, Agabe finishing the Magefa, so his whole discussion with God is not an introspective discussion, but it's a judgment of the situation, and that's why the Pasuk perhaps says, Ve'yipol el. So just I want to make one or two comments about the next Aliyah, just very quick, maybe halachic points. So it's a relatively long Aliyah, so just one interesting marmakom. It's an interesting question. So nowadays, people have children, so they very often will name the children after a relative who's no longer alive. In Ashkenazi tradition, a relative no longer alive, Sephardim name after relatives who are alive. And it's a whole discussion what regulates this practice, how exactly to go about it, what type of relatives, can you mix relatives, etc., etc. And we thought it's a little bit interesting to consider that the whole practice of naming people after other people seems to be a more recent practice, because that's not really what we find in the Torah or in Shas, even that late, that the names that are given in the Torah are mostly in honor of things or ideas or places. You don't find so much that people are named after people who came beforehand. So there are many opportunities in the Torah for that to happen. How come Moshe didn't name his son Avraham Avinu? How come none of Yaakov's sons who had children after Yaakov died, how come none of them were named Yaakov? We don't really find that in the Chumash people are named after other people, nor do you find that in the Gemara. It's really apparently a more recent type of phenomenon. So that's true for the most case, but it's interesting, it is pointed out by the Chizkuni that here you do have a precedent for it. That's in Pasuk Mem, where the Torah lists one of the descendants, one of the sons of Binyamin and his family. So it says, V'yu v'nei vela, Ard, v'na'aman, mishpachas Ardi, l'na'aman, mishpachas Anami. So those names, Ard and Na'aman, are familiar because those names were also names of sons of Binyamin. Binyamin had 10 sons, so these were two others in addition to Bela. So apparently Bela was naming his sons after his brothers, after the uncles and the sons, who, let's assume, maybe were not alive at that point. So if that's the case, this is a precedent already in the Chumash for naming kids after relatives. So it's not the common attitude that you find in the Chumash and in Shas, but it is something that we do today very commonly, and it does seem to at least have a marker over there. It's also an interesting point that the Ramban tells us that the figure of Sarach Bas Asher, very famous person in Chumash, mostly because Chazal tell us that she was the one who was musical and was able to gently break the news to Yaakov that Yosef was still alive. So here the Ramban tells us a surprise that the Sarach Bas Asher, he quotes Unklus as saying that we shouldn't read of Hashem Bas Asher, but rather of Vishum Bas Asher, meaning that she was not the daughter of Asher. And in fact, she was the daughter of Asher's wife from a previous marriage. And she's connected to Asher through this marriage, but she wasn't really his daughter. The Inquis I have in front of me, it says Vishum Bas Asher Sarach, and it has in parentheses after the word Bas, it says, Itas Ayin Ramban. So, meaning that you should read it, the daughter of the wife of Asher, and it puts Ayin Ramban in there to say, read the Ramban to understand why we're saying that. So this idea that she's connected to Asher is a fascinating idea, especially because she wasn't really his daughter. So there is a whole discussion about this in the halachic literature, and the Jewish Chasam Sofer and others, they quote this Ramban about the question of Ishtar, if you have a ksuba or the like. So is it legitimate to use the name of a step-parent or of an adoptive parent? Do you assume that that could have the name of a parent, a name that's used the same way a parent's name is used? And maybe there's a shtickle araya here, because the Torah is calling Sarach Bas Asher, even though she wasn't Bas Asher. So how did she get connected to Asher at all? So it seems to be because she had this mission together with him, that she took on his activities, and that they both took upon themselves to make sure to break the news gently to Yaakov. So in that sense, they were connected, and that's enough for the Torah to link them, even if there wasn't actually a biological link between them. And the Ramban says, this is here to show us that there'll be circumstances where a daughter will end up inheriting from the father, because she was the one who was left, so she was the one who inherited, even though the point is not, like it seems like, to tell us that she was actually the biological daughter of Asher. Okay, so there's a lot more one could say about these two aliyahs, but in the interest of time, we'll stop now. I'll wish everyone a wonderful Shabbos. Again, we won't meet tomorrow night, but we'll have, God willing, our final poem shir, Bez Hashem, Monday night here in this room at 7 o'clock. Everyone should have a wonderful night. Should be only good things. And I will see you then. Okay, Shkai Chafayim, so you'll be ma'amil that. How you doing? Have